off. Okay. So here we go. Let's see what we got. Okay. Oh, geez. Okay. Perfect. Perfect question from Richard. Should death be feared? No, absolutely not, Richard. Because there's nothing really to be afraid of when you understand death. The reason we're afraid of it is because we don't understand it. Fear is virtually synonymous with ignorance. We're afraid of what we don't know. And so when we really understand what death is, and boy, this has been a big deal thing for me for decades. My third book, I think, 400-page big thing, Preparing to Die. I am big into this topic. I've been teaching it for decades. And so, absolutely, positively not. There's fundamentally nothing to be afraid of. The only thing that dies is ignorance and its correlate, ego. Ego dies because ego doesn't really exist. Fake news dies. Illusion dies. This limited thing we call the form, the most superficial dimension of our being, that is released. And so, really, what the wisdom traditions say, the maxim here is die before you die, which is what meditation is about. You can discover all the stuff for yourself. And through the meditative arts, you can discover that which cannot die because it was never born. Let me say that again. You can discover for yourself that which cannot die because it was never born. That's the goal of these teachings, to discover the changeless, deathless nature, who you really are. This is the part of you that does not grow old, does not get cancer, AIDS, Alzheimer's, and it doesn't die. It's the innermost, truest dimension of your being. And if you can make this transition, if you can die before you die, which is what in Buddhism, that's what Bardo Yoga is all about this. Then death basically is seen to be an illusion, literally the death of death. So there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of, really. So easier said than done, because we're so exclusively identified with body, with form. That's actually what ego is, exclusive identification with form. And so when that form gets old, decrepit, falls apart, and dies, if you've invested your entire portfolio of identity in that, brace yourself, it's going to be rough because that's who you think you are. But the wisdom traditions radically, unequivocally say, no way, that's not who you are. That's a construct, it's who you think you are. So should death be feared? Absolutely not. There's nothing to be afraid of. Fear is the minion of ignorance. We're afraid of what we don't know. When you understand who you are, you understand what death is. In my view, death is just a wrathful form of liberation. Wrathful, why? Because it's non-negotiable and uncompromising. You can't do anything about it. But it basically returns you to the true nature of who you are. And so the program at SMC or DMC that I mentioned on the Dharmata, that's your true being. Just a fancy Sanskrit word for who you really are. This thermonuclear brilliance, luminosity, emptiness. That's who you really are. So the Dharmata Bardo, the Dharmata teachings are all about this true identity. And then the practices that allow you to release all the superficial dimensions, who really, they really are not you. The Hindus talk about it as the koshas. The Buddhists talk about it as the kayas. All the really wisdom traditions, I shouldn't say all because I haven't studied every one of them, but the most famous ones I have looked pretty deeply at. Nothing to fear. Trust me on this. Nothing. Okay. So, oh, okay. Second question for Mitch. Cool. He's on a roll. What are the karmic results of dying by stopping water and food? I have a friend that is planning this who has Alzheimer's. Yes, this is a good question. So this is what's called passive euthanasia. And the whole euthanasia business, this is the answer really depends on who you ask. And I have asked, especially when I was doing research for my book, I asked dozens and dozens of teachers, all these sorts of what I call the difficult questions. So I have a section in that book about miscarriage, abortion, euthanasia, suicide, the really difficult questions. And the way all where I come down on this, again, this is just my interpretation. But supported by great masters like Dingra Hinsa Rinpoche, Sogyal Rinpoche, Laka Rinpoche, others, that passive euthanasia is fine. That's what if I have the wherewithal, if I get Alzheimer's and I'm heading out that way, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to stop eating. I'm going to stop drinking. Passive euthanasia. It doesn't have karmic consequences, at least according to most of the teachers that I've asked. And so the intention behind it is really the fundamental ingredient, because if your intention is to relieve suffering, that's a good intention. There's nothing wrong with that. So the passive euthanasia, the traditions, to the best of my ability, and I've asked a ton of teachers, karmically, it seems to be quite okay. And that's hopefully, who knows, that's what I would do. Active euthanasia is a different thing. And again, it depends on who you ask. Some people say that's even fine. But most of the traditional expositions in at least Buddhism will say that should be avoided. And who am I? I don't know. I don't know the final details. There's only a fully awakened one, a Buddha, that understands the repercussions of karma. But active euthanasia, pretty much across the board, is to be avoided. Passive euthanasia seems to be okay. All right, from Georgia. Oh, this is an interesting one. Not that these others weren't. Is lucid dreaming happening within the human mind? Yes. So there's a number of questions unfolded here. So I'll ask them as they appear. Does lucid dreaming happen within the human mind? For sure. It's a metacognitive process within the human mind. If someone manages to transform themselves into a butterfly, for example, in the dream, I suppose you don't say in a dream, but I'm assuming you're saying in a dream, unless you're a really highly accomplished shaman, which would be really cool. If you can do that, shoot a YouTube clip and send it to me. I'll make you a billionaire. That would be pretty cool. Just joking. If someone manages to transform themselves into a butterfly, for example, I assume you're saying in a dream, would the person be able to see perceptions as a butterfly? No. Why would they? Because it's a phenomenological construct. It's a construct of your own mind. You're not literally embodying the biological matrix of a butterfly. So no, you wouldn't. Or would they see perceptions as a human being with the body of a butterfly? The latter. But again, try it. The best thing I can do is just try it. And then maybe read as much as you can about butterfly perceptions. I play with this because it's actually quite playful. I like this actually. I'm not making fun I'm making fun with you. Read as much about butterfly perceptions. And you may think, okay, well, where can I find data on that? Well, I recommended this book a lot. I read it. It was the number one recommended book in the New York Times bestseller, or highly recommended, the top 10 books. It's called An Immense World, An Immense World by Ed Yong, I think Yong. It's all about what's called Umwelt in German, the kind of the worldview, the perceptual bubbles that all kinds of beings, all kinds of animals inhabit. It's a fantastic read because it really gives you, to the best of the scientist's ability, and a glimpse of how all these amazing creatures. I was blown away by the chapter on ultrasound and bats, and then the whales and how they perceive. I just love this book. It's a little long, it gets a little academic, but it's extremely well written. Slight sidebar, but I highly recommend it. It's a great read because it talks about the relativistic nature of perception, that what we see in the consensual reality that we know is human perception. This is just a highly edited, filtered way through biological processes that we see what is fundamentally unperceivable within this matrix. So would you see the perceptions as a butterfly? No. Why would you? That doesn't make sense to me. You would probably see the perceptions as a human being with the body of a butterfly. But hey, try it. Make a strong intention to a lucid dream. I want to arise as a butterfly. See what happens, quite literally, see what you see, and then get back to me. I've never tried that, but it's a cool thing to give a crack. And there's also this, the Chinese little proverb about this, right? The butterfly that dreams they're human, the dreams they're a butterfly, that whole thing. Maybe that's where you got it. Okay, last part regarding lucidity in deep dream. Yes, that's clear light, yoga nidra, luminosity yoga. Okay. Does it happen within, there's a typo here, does it happen within a human being mind? It does for us. Or is it in a subtler form of mind which is beyond human? Well, this latter part of the question, this is a good one. Yes, we will perceive it within the human being mind because we don't really have an option. But is it a subtler form? I just hear my dog crying. If he keeps up, I might have to bring him down, in which case I can introduce you to him. Hold on a second. Say hi. Right. Let's say hi. Okay, so I have to introduce you. This is my wonderful but highly neurotic dog. I love this guy to death. His name is Tashi. Tashi is Tibetan, which means hello, good fortune. And he's a complete, what we call rodeo drive dog. He should be walking down with a Gucci purse. He's such a wuss. And so what happens is when there's a slightest intimation of discomfort, he sits down outside my study and just does this ridiculous whine. So there he is. Maybe I'll have a dream to see how Tashi perceives the world. He's the best. Okay, so sorry for the distraction, but we have to be kind to our animal brothers and sisters. Is the clear light mind, lucid dream sleep, a subtler form of mind which is beyond human? This latter part is really interesting because, yes, it's actually pre-human. Just like the eighth consciousness is pre-human. And so even though we don't have an option but to perceive it within the human mind because we're embodied in a human matrix, but fundamentally the eighth consciousness, the substrate consciousness, and even deeper, the clear light mind which gives birth to the substrate, this is pre-human. This is a quality of awareness that all sentient life possesses. So even when an insect transitions, when any sentient life force transitions, they will transition to this pre-human, pre-spatial, pre-temporal, pre-causal dimension, which is called the clear light mind. So that last part is, that's a really good one. Okay. Okay, from Patrick. Is the 49-day rule for reincarnation set in stone for all Buddhists? No, nothing in Buddhism is set in stone except nothing, which is emptiness. But even emptiness is empty. There's literally a wonderful book called The Emptiness of Emptiness. The only thing that's set in stone is emptiness. And in a Zen kind of koan way, try to wrap your mind around that. But the 49-day rule, I've asked a ton of teachers about this as well. It comes from the Chittagarbha Sutra. This actually comes from the Sutra tradition. And I mean, who knows, right? Nobody really knows what the Buddha taught. Nothing was really written down until at least 200 years after his death. So you can imagine the amount of interpretation slash distortion that happened in those 200 years. So scholars are wrestling with this stuff like all the time. But the 49-day rule, I mean, it is like, don't ask me. But again, my understanding is it set in stone? Absolutely not. You can, Laka Rinpoche playfully talks about bardo VIPs. These are individuals with either really good karma, in other words, really powerful habit patterns, or really bad karma that don't actually experience a bardo at all. The minute they die, it's called heavy karma. It's so powerful, it's so strong. Boom, they're in a heaven realm. Boom, they're in a hell realm, if you believe this cosmological stuff. For the rest of us, the reason it takes 49 days, or mostly 3.5 weeks. Again, this is just what the tradition says. So with this material, I'm just being a mouthpiece. I'm not speaking with any experience, with any authority, outside of some, you might say, scholarship authority. But basically what creates the 49 days, or this indeterminate period, which can last a whole lot shorter and a whole lot longer, you can get stuck in the bardos. And if you believe in this stuff, become what's called a manomaya, gandharva, or in Western languaging, a kind of a ghost. And so they can hang out, you know, for like who knows how long, right? But for most of us, because we're a mishmash of good habits, good karma, bad karma, in a particular process that, don't ask me, it takes about, on average, 49 days for this stuff to be sorted out. Can souls reincarnate before or after that period? Absolutely, positively. A Buddhist would not use the word soul. Patrick, I understand what you're saying, but soul is literally a four-letter word. In Buddhism, there's no reified soul. There is an essence, but this whole soul thing, this you will not find this in Buddhist languaging. There's no Atman. Okay, how is it determined? Don't ask me. That's in the Cittagarbha Sutra, first rendering that I've ever come across. And then the Bardo Tantric literature just took it on. So that's, I don't know any more than what I just shared. I heard of a monk who was such a pure spirit that his soul reincarnated into five people. Yes, this is what happened to Jamgon Kongtrul Lodur Thay. Okay, so here we go. This is where we step into hardcore Buddhist metaphysics. And do I have any first-person verification of any of this? No way, not even close. So I'm simply going to tell you what I've read here. I have no personal conviction or experience with this stuff. But what you're talking about here is actually not at all uncommon, where a particular mind stream can trifurcate into all these different streams under processes that who knows, I don't know what those are. And they can manifest not only, now check this out. You want to see how wild this gets? The whole teachings on the Bardo becoming and what's called diversified Nirmanakaya or variegated tukku. This is where you can check this out. This is what the literature says. It's mind bending. You can come back not only as more than one person. You can come back as an animal. You can come back as any so-called physical thing. Because there is no physical thing. Physicality, materiality is pure imputation. It's an explanatory abstraction on a world of ideation made of mind. The world is not made of matter. And that's why the stuff, when you hear it, if you're not somewhat spiritually oriented, is just bullshit. But when you realize, like what they say with emptiness, central teaching in Buddhism, with an understanding of emptiness, everything is possible. Without an understanding, nothing is possible. And so emptiness slash mind, not just this limited, finite, cognitive, space-time coordinate mind, but deep, clear light mind. This is pre-temporal, pre-spatial, trans-temporal, trans-spatial. This mind can assume any form. And the literature is actually quite explicit about this. And this is another one of the questions when I first read about this stuff. It was such a mind F. It was such a, like, what? That I tracked it down. I asked as many teachers that I really deeply trust, really high lamas, high Rinpoches. I asked them this sort of thing. And they talk just with immediate, unflappable conviction that yes, you can come back as any a medicine, a bridge, a breeze. And when I first heard this with my scientific background, I said, bullshit, there's just no way. But then I really worked with it a little bit because, okay, what's my resistance here? Why is this such an impossibility? Well, because it's exposing my materialistic, physicalistic way. And within that view, this is nuts. But with a world made of heart, mind, spirit, matter, hey, who knows? And why would these amazing teachers lie about this stuff? I don't know. But there's a whole literature on this. Tulku Tundup Rinpoche wrote an entire book where this is talked about. I think it's literally called, it's in my library just outside the door. What's the title? Something like Rebirth or Tuku. I apologize. I have so many books on, like, this is just a quarter of my library on the Bardo stuff. I don't remember off the top of my head, but Tuku Tundup Rinpoche wrote an entire book on this. It's standard fare. So his soul reincarnated into five people. Yes, not uncommon. Yes. Is it theoretically possible to reincarnate in more than five people? Yes. They say the Karmapas have the capacity to arise as a billion. Again, is this hyperbole? Is this pure metaphor? Is it literal? I don't know. So I'm speaking purely as a representative of what's in the literature. I have no personal experience with this. Is death kind of like the latter reincarnation, but way bigger, a reincarnation to infinite spirit? Well, it's a return in, it's a return of the finite mind into infinity, for sure. So absolutely positively, or the vast entropic soup. Yeah, that's a wonderful phrase that Bernardo Kastrup uses. Yes, you return to the vast entropic soup. I love when Bernardo riffs on this. What he says, I really like this guy a lot. He's a pretty bright guy. And he says, one of the contexts where this comes from, and I suspect you may have got it from that or me riffing on him, is that if we were to somehow actually perceive in our physical body reality as it really is, we would dissolve into an entropic soup. I just love that phrase. But anyway, yes, the infinite mind, the finite mind dissolves into infinite spirit. That's what in Buddhism is called the Dharmata. Vast entropic soup, yes, that can connect to all living beings. Absolutely, positively. Is this how dead monks are able to give teachings and dreams? Yes, for sure. And as my dear friend Bob Thurman talks about, there are no dead people. I love this with Bob. I love his languaging. This guy's just amazing. He just says point blank, and Bob is effing brilliant, right? He basically says there are no dead people. So there are no dead monks. The monk is just pinched awareness, just like we are. And so when you drop this costume, like, you know, one day when Tashi dies, he's going to drop his puppy costume. And who knows, he might take a human costume on, mosquito costume. I drop this human costume, I might take on a puppy costume. So this is why I have to be really nice to my dog, because if I'm not, we could switch places. And if I'm not nice to him, he's going to repeat the favor when we switch places, right? So the idea, you know, tongue in cheek, this is all like whatever, goofy metaphysics or whatever. But the fundamental principles underlying this are actually quite elegant and quite profound. And exploring this in tremendous detail, this is a big deal thing. So this is what the Bardo teachings, I mean, they riff on this stuff a ton. And so, Patrick, involved with your question here, the three, four questions you have in here, is a ton of really quite profound things. But perhaps the take-home message with what you're saying for me is realizing the interconnectivity, the kind of connective tissue of all beings, that with the realization of emptiness, everything is possible. This is where miracles come from. This is where all the wonderful things that all the wisdom traditions talk about that seem completely ridiculous from a materialistic point, they only become possible, they become completely tenable. It's almost inevitable. So I'm going to let that go, because otherwise we're going to riff the entire time on that one. It's a really great set of questions. Okay, so here's a couple more that came in. Okay, all right, so this one really literally just came in. Hi, I'm so excited to be here, having just discovered you through your fascinating 10% happier interview with Dan Harris. Well, thank you for that. I really had fun with him. He's a very gifted interviewer. I've been looking for answers to my nightly nightmares for years. I used to be a lucid dreamer and remember many recurrent dreams from my lifetime. Cool. I'm going to run a little commentary as I go through this because it's a little bit long. Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche says playfully, and it makes a lot of sense to me, recurrent dreams mean you're not a good listener. Unless you have something like PTSD, I would actually maybe challenge a little bit that thing. PTSD is or trauma itself is a different league. But most of the time when we have over-the-counter recurrent dreams, it's because the letters aren't being opened and read. Like what did Freud say? An uninterpreted dream is like an unopened letter. So you're not opening the letter, you're not reading it, you're not getting it. And so the postman keeps delivering it. And, you know, it just keeps coming back until you get it. And recurrent dreams can be very effective for working with dream signs, very effective for cultivating lucidity itself. Back to you. In my most recent nightmare, I remembered that I'd volunteered to look after a toddler and a baby with a very dark skin. And to my horror, I realized I hadn't checked on them for ages. And I couldn't find them or remember when I'd last hugged them or changed their nappies and fed them. The background of the dream was a lot of other chaos of me having too many responsibilities and trying to work as a photographer. My job in real life, cool. But having many hurdles and many people around me wanting different things. Yeah, like welcome to the stressful modern age, right? My main feeling was a sense of impending doom. This is really common, unfortunately. And a questioning of my true self. How could I do such a thing as neglect these babies? It seemed my whiteness played a part that I was devastated about too. The themes of the dream are consistent with my normal dreaming life. I wake feeling exhausted from relentless obstacles and traveling in a sense of impending failure. In my real life, I'm this age with this particular family situation. I do yoga, meditation, all the things, but at night it's the same every night. Okay, so there's not a question here, but maybe you're wanting a little bit of just commentary on this. Yeah, you know, dreams are truth tellers. It's psychological arenas, at psychological levels and spiritual levels. I mean, the moniker for dream yoga, for instance, is the measure of the path. So they measure you, they reveal you. And sometimes we don't want to be so revealed. And so in terms of like maybe like what to do with all that, well, there's a number of things to do. One is if you really want to understand and interpret this dream, then approach it from that lens. And there's so many different schools of interpretation. Jungian depth psychology is fantastic. I particularly like Eugene Genlin's book called Let Your Body Interpret Your Dream. So you can gain a deep understanding of what this recurrent dream may be signifying, representing by striving. Write the dream down, write it down, date it, title it, circle or highlight all the recurrent features, and then start to suss it out, start to work with it. Robert Moss has some really interesting things to say about this sort of thing, that some of these dreams, it's like he says in his languaging, he says, my recent interview with him, by the way, on Edge of Mind, you can hear him say this, my recent interview. He says, it's like the gods want to make you sweat. They don't want to make the dream this easy and accessible for interpretation. So you have to work with it. You have to work at it. Sometimes I have dreams like this where I'll actually incubate another dream to help me understand one, or I will talk to my dream friends, veteran experienced dreamers as my advisors, you know, help me understand this sort of thing. So that's one thing, again, that may be of interest to you is like, what does that really represent? What does it mean? And then in terms of like purifying it or working with it, this can be done through stress management. You talk about yoga meditation and things like that. But sometimes yoga meditation doesn't get at this stuff. This is a type of spiritual bypass that happens a lot in the community. It's like, oh, my meditation will handle everything. Oh, my yoga will handle everything. I don't think so. Doesn't seem to work that way. So I roll in an integral world. I think the psychotherapeutic approaches, depth psychology, this stuff has a real place on the path of human psychospiritual development. I would not hesitate for a second to work with a gifted therapist to help unfold, unpack some of these things, and to resolve some of these underlying discords. Because when you're having this, there's some dissonance, there's some rub, there's something that's not quite right. And your body is sending up constantly, just sending up this vibe. And until that vibe is somewhat processed, purified, released, it's going to keep sending it. So again, there's no overt question here, Penny, but that's what I would do. I would look in therapeutic capacities like depth psychology or someone who works with this more explicitly. And then, you know, in terms of dream interpretation, not classically part of dream yoga. Dream yoga doesn't care about that kind of thing, but that doesn't dismiss it from a psychological point of view. So unless you're here and want to ask a specific follow-up, I'll let that go because there is not a specific question there. So one last one, and then we'll open it up for, I think, everybody. For Marie, this one also just came in. How do we go back into a dream a night later? Do we simply set the intent and fall asleep thinking about it? Yeah, that's by far the easiest way to go about it. I mean, allegedly, who was it? Descartes, allegedly, derived some of the main principles of his Cartesian philosophy through a dream, a contiguous dream that he had, I think, three nights in a row. I have not had this type of dream, but I know a number of people who have. How do we do it? What you're saying is by far the best in terms of my understanding. You set the intentionality. I want to go back into that dream. I want to pick up that thread. I want to develop it. Where do I find the four dharmas of dreaming? Yeah, that if you're here, I can ask you where you heard that. I talk about the four dharmas of dreaming in some of my programs. I don't remember where, because I do so many of these, but this is my reformulation of the classic, what are called the four dharmas of Gampopa. Grant your blessings so that my mind may become one with the Dharma. Grant your blessings so the Dharma may progress along the path. And then the other two. I basically take that kind of structure from Gampopa and riff it into this four dharmas of dreaming. So if you found it, Marie, somewhere other than me, I would love to hear where you heard that, because not that I'm proprietary about it, but I kind of came up with that. It just made sense to me. And I apologize. I don't remember where. I mean, I write and teach about this stuff so much. I don't remember where I first penned it. I apologize. When coming out of a blissful dream, so this is question three. When coming out of a blissful dream, I don't think about going back in because I'm in a state of bliss. Yeah, why would you? Celebrate the bliss. Why go back in? What can I do to help remind myself to stay in the dream or go back? Oh, okay. Well, why would you want to do that? I'm not saying it's not a bad idea, but I'm very curious. Why would you want to do that? Why not just bask in the glow and the bliss of the dream? If you want to go back in, you can do mnemonic induction of lucid dreaming, which is a classic four-part approach to kind of working yourself back into not just a dream, but a dream that then becomes lucid. This is Stephen LaBerge's classic. It's called the MILE technique, mnemonic induction of lucid dreams. It's a very skillful way through practice to work your way back into any dream. I recommend his books. I write about this in this one. I do remember in my Harbinger Press book called The Lucid Dreaming Workbook. I talk about the MILE technique in some detail, but this is Stephen LaBerge's innovation. I can't remember where, probably Exploring the World of Lucid Dreaming. That's definitely worth exploring. Okay, so when in a blissful dharmic dream, do I try to tell myself this is a dream? I mean, you can. There's nothing wrong with that. But why not just bask in the bliss? Why not just bathe in that kind of affective response? If you want to go back in and tell yourself that it's a dream, which would then imply you're bringing lucidity to it, that's fine. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to do, but I probably would just hang out in the bliss. I mean, like, why not? Dharma is emptiness. True. So do I just remain in the bliss, or do I try to remind myself this is a dream? Well, you know, that's up to you. You know, this is an interesting one. I'm not sure I have something that would be like the definitive best thing to do. You might, if you have the luxury of experiencing these sort of things with some regularity, what I always recommend is play with both approaches. See what happens when you just hang out in the bliss. Where does that go? What does it turn out to be? What does that end up as? Just see, be curious. If you have the experience, sometimes he just has to express himself. Sorry. Or do you want to remind yourself that this is a dream? If you have the opportunity to do that on another night, I would play with both options. Is there one that's superior to the other? I don't think so. So this is a little bit of the exploration thing, Marie, that one of the cool things about, especially dream yoga, yes, there's nine stages. Yes, there's some classic things that you do. But there's also a lot of kind of collateral benefits and a lot of personal exploration that can take place, where you just go in there and you just work these sorts of things out. I mean, I would say, I don't know what the percentage is, but a pretty high percentage of my most revelatory transforming dreams have come about somewhat serendipitously, where I just have this intentionality of curiosity and exploration. And just like the most amazing sort of thing happens, it's not in literature. I never read about it. I never came across it. And it's like, whoa, I didn't know my mind could do that. I didn't know I had access to this sort of thing. And so I get a little bit, I wouldn't say nervous, but just interested when there's this kind of question or suggestions about shrink wrapping into the shoulds. You know, you should be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that. I'm much more playful and relaxed about these sorts of things. They're all wonderfully revelatory, beneficial, interesting, fascinating adventures in consciousness. And so if I were you, if you have these with some regularity, I would explore all the different options and then just see what floats your boat. Something like that. Does that make sense? Say yes. Makes me feel better. Okay.
She's here.
Okay, Marie, fire away. If you're here, unmute yourself and now my dog is wimping because I closed the door on him. This is my life. It's like, remember the Flintstones? Those of you who are old enough, you remember the Flintstones? The cat was in, the cat was out, the cat was in, and then eventually the cat picks the human and puts the human outside the door. This is my dog. Oh, hold on. Tashi?
Penny, did I get you unmuted?
And gosh, I wonder how he got so spoiled. How did that happen? It's because I'm such a sucker. You know, he's got such an adorable face. Like, how are you going to discipline something that looks that cute, right? We actually took him to a trainer, like when we first got him. And when the trainer saw the dog, he goes, I can't do anything with this dog. I can't train this dog. He's too cute, right? And so, you know, we take him to the Dairy Queen, or the puppy analog to the Dairy Queen. He's spoiled, crapless. And then I wonder why he's such a neurotic mess. Well, you know, he's my kid. I made him that way. Okay, Marie, fire away if you're here.
I think I lost him.
Did she disappear? Well, come on back when you can. Okay, Marie asked a question also. Who is the author? I apologize. I'm reading the chat column here, and I'll get to Jerry. The author of which book? I apologize. Oh, yes, Immense World. Yeah, Ed Yong. Thanks, Anne. Yes, that book. Oh, yeah. Okay, there we go. Barry, a friend recently commented on his nightmares as being like free movie tickets. Okay, that's an interesting comment. Okay. Can we use recurrent dreams as a dream sign? High five, Jessica. Good for you. Exactly. So with a recurrent dream, like I mentioned, you highlight the recurrent patterns, images, whatever. You memorize those as dream signs. And so then when the dream occurs, you're sensitized to that particular appearance. You recognize it. Oh, yeah, there's whatever again. I must be dreaming. So that's how you can use recurrent dreams to initiate lucidity. From Penny, I'm here. Okay, I'm here. Okay. If I work on that dream specifically tonight in my dream, how would I proceed? Well, I mean, what if you have some facility, Penny, with things like lucidity, then I would work with cultivating a lucid relationship to the experience. Because then your conscious mind can face these unconscious elements directly and start to work with them and transform them directly. And so this is actually part of stage 4 of dream yoga, where you work intentionally with frightful circumstances to realize that fundamentally whatever arises is really of the fabric of mind. And then fundamentally, there's nothing in there that can hurt you. It's just your mind arising in this particular expression. And with a quality of lucidity, you can do one of two things. You can witness what's called pellucidity. You can witness that dream from a lucid stance. You're aware that you're dreaming. You watch it. That'll actually add a little bit of extra oomph to the dream itself, that just simply witnessing in a lucid capacity the dream. But in terms of like transforming the contents, then that's a little bit more involved. That would involve developing lucidity and then facing some of these unconscious, creepy, uncomfortable states and going directly into them. Because in particular, when we're having kind of nightmarish things, and yours didn't really talk about situations like when you're being chased or pursued or anything like that. But if there's something untoward, with a quality of lucidity and the confidence born from it, the invitation is actually to go somewhat in the spirit of the reverse practices. You go directly into those shadow elements. You go directly into those unwanted experiences and extract the light within them. So this is a deeper question, Penny. One of the challenges with a platform like this is really wonderful, rich sharings like yours and a really great question like yours. It's challenging for me in short, clever sound bites to give you really definitive ways to work with this. This is something where working with a dream interpreter, a practitioner, someone who can actually work this through with you is much more efficacious than me pinging out a couple sound bites over a 2-minute period, right? So I hope you understand it. The other thing I might refer you to, my dear friend, she's so dear, I forgot her name, Claire Johnson. I have 2 interviews with her on the Nightclub platform, by the way. She's a jewel, PhD, actually in lucid dreaming. One of her most recent books is The Art of Transforming Nightmares. I endorse this thing. It's a brilliant book. I highly recommend it because not only does she bring this about from a psychological point of view, talking about PTSD, trauma, stress, because she's a lucid dreamer, she also brings in a lucid nightmare therapy. It's a really wonderful, the best thing I've read yet on working with uncomfortable, difficult dreams from a really savvy, seasoned dreamer. So the Art of Transforming Nightmares by Claire Johnson, I highly recommend that book. I wish I could be a little bit more rigorous, complete, but I think you understand with the limitations of this platform, there's only so much I can really do. So thanks for your understanding. And thanks for coming tonight. And then there's my dear friend, Dr. J. Fire away, Dr. J. And if Marie's here and wants to come unmuted, we'll get her right after Dr. J.
Hi, Andrew.
Hey, buddy.
Well, you know, you mentioned before, and actually you started this talk off about talking about the 49 days after death.
Yeah.
And you said, for example, I think in someone said that the Buddha, after he attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, sat there for 49 days.
Yeah, I shared that last week. Yeah, that's what they say.
Well, anyways, the point is almost all religions, including, you know, the Christian religion, Jewish religion, they assign special meaning to numbers. Like, for sure. As for perfection, 7 is supposed to be very spiritual, and 6 is bad because it's 1 less than 7. And if you multiply that, like 666, that's the number of the beast. Well, what I was thinking is 7 appears as a magic number in many different contexts. And if you square 7, you get 49.
Right.
So do you think that's where that comes from?
I have no idea, my friend. Your guess is as good as mine. You know, the numerology thing is actually quite interesting. For instance, another really interesting power number is 108. It's a curious, check it out. Ask the real guru, Google guru, Google it. Google just to see what's out there. Google the numerology or the spiritual significance of the number 108. And you're going to find like 108 different reasons why it's so interesting. Right? I actually find it interesting. I don't really roll in that kind of world. I'm not a numerologist. I'm not dissing it or criticizing it. I just don't really know about that sort of thing. But there are power points, just like there are acupuncture points. There are these kind of particular things that have more impact. Like, are they completely cultural? To me, that actually makes a lot of sense. Why would like 666 be such a tragic number? Like, who came up with that? Again, I just don't know. So I remain agnostic on this. I try to be open-minded to it and not drift into some of the purely metaphysical New Age conjectures about it. And so to me, one of my favorite answers that I just love saying is, I don't know. There's something tremendously liberating about it. Dafri John talked about it as divine ignorance. The Zen tradition talks about it as don't know mind. There's something quite beautiful about just saying, I don't know, right? It's like, cool, I'm done. Best I can do, my friend.
that's exactly the way I feel. I was just wondering if that's where the number 49 came from. It's not necessarily that I believe in it. I don't necessarily disbelieve in it. It's just something that came up.
Exactly. It's there. Who knows? But I do know the earliest I can track it down is to the Tathagata Sutra. That's where they talk about it. Did the Buddha say this? Again, who knows? I mean, nothing was written down until over 200 years after he died. Nobody really knows what he said, right?
Okay, one more question. You know, you talked about the, what are the six yokas of Naropa?
Sure, uh-huh.
And I think you explicitly, one way or the other, talked about four of them. Well, I had surgery several years ago on my foot, and I had to lay down and keep my foot elevated most of the day. And I went out and bought a book by Lama Yeshe, who died, I think, in 1984 in California from cardiac disease, I think.
Yeah, wonderful Gelugpa Lama. I love him. Love his
book. And he wrote the book, I think. It's called The Bliss of Inner Fire.
It's exactly what it's called. Yeah.
And since he says right in the introduction, don't try this without a master. I mean, he said that right off the bat, but yeah. I read the whole book and I had to be laying down most of the day. So I tried it and I really had some incredible experience.
I'm sorry, go ahead. What's the question, bud? Sorry.
Your experience, or have you read it? Or?
Well, I've read it multiple times.
I'm
a big fan of Lama Yeshe. I think he's a beautiful teacher. And The Bliss of Inner Fire is the best public over-the-counter book on Tummo Chandali, the inner heat yogas out there. It's really good. So it's just the first, it's called the main beam. It's the first and the main practice of the six dharmas. The other, like you mentioned, they're what are called the four root dharmas. So it's Chandali, illusory form, dream yoga, sleep yoga. And then there's the two so-called supplemental dharmas, which is Bardo Yoga and Poa. And so these are also divvied up into waking, dreaming, and sleeping and dying states, right? So basically they're parsed out that way. So the six dharmas are the crowning jewel in the Karmakagyu tradition. They're incredibly powerful practices. I practiced them for an entire year in my three-year retreat. They've been a central part of my life ever since. And the Lama Yeshe book, The Bliss of Inner Fire, is the best public book on inner heat yogas out there to date. I still find it quite brilliant. So yeah, I agree with you. It's a great read. Surgeon, you're a doc, you know, Surgeon General warnings here, right? These are prescription strength practices, and they may be hazardous to your egoic health. So you have to be a little careful when you start exploring these really deep practices. There are a number of practices in the wisdom traditions that are dangerous, because they're so powerful. Poa's one, dark retreats one, Chandali's one, because the inner heat yoga targets the body, the subtle body, and it works directly with opening and releasing all the energy in the subtle channel system and basically burning up the karmic knots. That's what the inner fire is about. It's completely separate from the Wim Hof performance Tummo. Now, I'm not criticizing Wim Hof's thing. I actually like what the guy's doing. But I do raise some eyebrows about the whole performance Tummo, that the whole thing is about sitting in an ice bucket for an hour and a half and not like dying. No, man. I mean, that is a complete sidebar. The physical heat is a complete sidebar to real Tummo. So that's performance Tummo. I'm not saying it doesn't have some validity, but to think that that's the essence of the inner yogas, I mean, not even close. So be careful, you know, Lama Yeshe's warning is a good one, where you start to deal with really charged prescription strength practices. You have to be a little careful because I just wrote an article for Tarka magazine. They had a whole special issue on Tantra. And I wrote this little piece on is the West ready for Tantra? I excerpted it and it's on my main website. You'll find it, andrewhalachek.com, is the West ready for Tantra? So if you're thinking about playing with this sort of stuff, I recommend you look at that. because a lot of people in the West hopscotch over the preliminaries, they jump into this sort of stuff, and then they get hurt, they get in trouble. So the Tantra thing, it's like, oh, you know, it has a lot of incredible power and promise. But if you don't handle it like electricity, really carefully, it's not going to light you up. It's going to burn you up. You got to be a little careful with this kind of stuff. It's generally not taught in public for just those reasons, because people come in, they're in a hurry, they're impatient, you know, enlightenment in one lifetime thing. You know, it's like, I got till Friday. Can I get enlightened by Friday? Right. And so they jump into these really, you know, like Aaron Rodgers doing this dark retreat thing. Hey, on one level, yeah, kind of cool. On another level, whoa, just be careful. So anyway, that's as far as I'm going to go on that.
Okay.
So, Marie, yeah, you're welcome, my friend. Marie, if you're there.
Yes, I saw Marie.
Okay, come on back on.
Okay, I think I figured it out.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
I can. Yes. Hello?
Were you asking me a question, or just did you answer my questions?
Well, I answered the questions that you submitted in writing to the best of my ability. So if you have something else you want to say?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so is there anything else you want to add, or how can I help you?
No. I thought she brought me on. I must have clicked something. No, I didn't have any other questions right now.
Okay, cool.
I mean, I do, but.
Well, nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Nice to say hi. Okay.
You too.
Yeah, so from Jessica here. Jessica, what was the name of the article? So, yes, it's called, Is the West Ready for Tantra? And I did post it. It's on my main website, andrewholacek.com. You'll see it kind of front and center. It's just a way to look at Tantra with more careful eyes. All right. From Rich, what is the process, the facts that determine the next form of life? Okay, so this is what Padmasambhava said. If you want to know your past life, look at your previous, your current situation. If you want to know your future life, look at your current actions. And so this is also completely resonant with a very powerful sutra teaching. And this is really great. Every legitimate spiritual teacher should memorize these. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequence of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I stand. So you want to know what's going to determine your next life is this life. What type of rebirth do you take place moment to moment? I'm not kidding here. Mindscape leads to landscape. Epistemology leads to ontology. And so if you're a person, you want to know what's going to dictate your next life. And this is good to know, because then you can control it. If you're an angry, bitter, resentful kind of person, you're practicing rebirth into the hell realms, because you're practicing hellish states of mind. If you're really kind of greedy, self-serving, narcissistic, you're paving the way either into the jealous God realms or the hungry ghost realms, because you're reincarnating in those states of mind now. So the phenomenology of rebirth, not only does it take place at the end of this life, it takes place moment to moment to moment. The mind, the formless mind, the clear light mind, is always taking rebirth. And usually, if we don't take some voluntary control, this is what lucidity principle is all about, and direct the rebirth of our mind moment to moment, well, guess what controls it? Your habits. Habits. You think you have free will? You think you decide what you're doing in this life? Vast majority, no way. Your habits decide for you. Just like what happens in a non-lucid dream. If you're not conscious in the dream, and your mind is reincarnating, in other words, taking form in the shape of a dream, who's making those choices if you're not consciously? Your habits. It's like Trungpa Rinpoche again famously said, what is it that, when he was asked, what is it that reincarnates, right? How did he say it? Your bad habits. So you want to know what your next life is going to be? Look at the type of mind that you inhabit now. And so therefore, cultivate the best thing, the single best thing you can do. You can forget about all this highfalutin spiritual stuff, even though, yes, it has a place. You want to have a good rebirth, lead a good life. Be kind, loving, compassionate. It's going to lay a red carpet for you in the Bardos. And then those good habit patterns, that good karma is going to take good care of you. So what determines the next life? Your habits, your karma. Habit is just a Western translation for karma. Okay? All righty. Anything else? We're right at the hour mark, which is usually when we start to close things up. So it's like the auction going once, going twice. Sold, done for today. Anything else before we close for today? Are we good? If so,
I think Anita's got her hands up.
Who? Oh, I think she's just waving.
Anita, are you
waving goodbye or do you have something to say? Oh, she does have something to say. Buzzer shot. Oh my God, Jessica has something to say. Oh, okay. We'll close the door after Jessica. It's all good.
What you said, it's a wonderful news for me.
Oh, good.
Because when I'm asked or when I wonder what I'm going to be next life or how you call it, I always say I want to be an artist, and that's what I do now. So it means that I'm going to be an artist again?
I can't tell you for sure, dear.
But you just said.
Right, but can I tell you with complete authority? So here's the deal. An artist is a particular expression of particular qualities of mind. So my question would be to you, what is it that characterizes the artist's mind? Are you going to come back as a literal artist? I have no idea. But if you nurture particular qualities that you associate with your artistry, then that could help you lead a particular artistic life. Is it going to be the same way that you relate to artists' principle now? I have no idea.
But I don't care.
Okay.
If I have to choose, I'm going to be an artist again.
Yeah. So here's the one thing I might invite, just as an exploration. I might invite you to explore the artist principle. In other words, what does being an artist really mean to you? Is it about freedom? Is it about creative expression? Is it about originality? I would actually do this with as a contemplation. Don't worry about specific artists. I'm a musician, right? So I'm a musical artist. Don't worry about that. What I might just simply suggest as a contemplation is write down the qualities. When you think of artist principle, what is it that actually qualifies an artist? Write those down. And then you might discover, let me finish.
Art principles are eternal evolution, because when you are 20.
Then you write that down. That's fine. What I'm trying to point out to you is be a little bit more articulate and specific, because then that type of specificity can perhaps help you. And you may find it's like Trungpa Rinpoche, one of his main things was artistry in everyday life. Paint on the canvas of your mind, paint on the canvas of your life, and use your entire life as an expression of your artistry, not just a particular medium of that expression. See? So to
it's
me-
It's like that to be an artist. It's your whole life.
That's what I'm saying. And that's what Trungpa Rinpoche tried to exemplify with all the things he did in his life. He basically painted his mind throughout his entire life. And so this kind of artist principle, to me, is what's more compelling than some of the more specific iterations of that principle.
Okay. Good news. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, Jessica, fire away, and then we'll close the door after you.
Oh, I was just going to ask if you could repeat that quote about our actions and not being able to escape. Yeah.
Yes, I can. Yes. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequence of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I stand. a lot of so-called spiritual teachers that would do good to memorize this and study it and put it on their refrigerator. Because again, don't get me going on this, I get really pissed off. Alleged spiritual people, you know, that then do all these crazy abuse things, scandal things, like they miss this fundamental Theravadin point. It's all about how you act in the world, what you do in the world. Not so much what flops out of your mouth. Anybody can blow smoke out of their mouth. It's like what you do to help people. It's what you do to help the planet. It's what you do to help others. And so to me, the real, you know, this is a beautiful thing. My teacher, Kenpo Rinpoche, once shared a story about one of his senior students that he said, this guy is one of my most advanced students. And then he shared, he goes, you want to know why? It's not because he's mastered the six dharmas and done all these highfalutin things. He goes, no, it's because he took a year out of his life to help his mother die. So you really want to know, you want to see the metric, the meter of someone who's really accomplished as a spiritual practitioner? Look at what they do in the world, not what they say. Yes, it helps. You know, sometimes they can say cool things, but how do they manifest? What do they do behind the scenes? How are they working for the benefit of others? And so with that said, when we close our little sessions together, this is a thing that's in the Buddhist traditions called dedication of merit. If it means something to you, great. If it doesn't, don't worry about it. But this is my big rant, and everything I do right now is if what we're doing here with our gatherings, which are, I think they're lovely. I love them. They're so cool. But if what we're doing here is not of benefit to the world today, it's irrelevant. We're just new age, feel good, whatevers. We're just lost in feeling comfortable and spiritual. So everything really for me is like, okay, how can we take these incredible lofty principles, not get stuck in spiritual bypass, and help this world and help others and animals and sent in the planet itself that is in a heap of hurt. I mean, I was just listening to a podcast, another amazing, incredibly unsettling podcast about a guy who wrote a book on fresh air. I read it, heard it. The heat will kill you first. Again, just you just have to read about what is happening with global warming. Really study it, the uninhabitable or inhabitable earth. Read this stuff, get it into your system. We're in big, serious trouble. And if we don't really honor that, really wake up to it, and then do something about it. What we're doing here, it's irrelevant. Not only will Buddhism go extinct, everything's going to go extinct. The Anthropocene, we're in it. We're in the Anthropocene, and it's big trouble. So again, it's like, oh, don't tell me that. I don't want to be uncomfortable. I want to feel good. Sorry. This is reality. And so with that said, what we can do here, because reality is really of the nature of mind and heart, we gather our merit to whatever extent, and we send it off to all sentient beings, to the planet itself, as a way to share what we're doing here and always remind ourselves that we're doing this. Yes, we're doing it for ourselves provisionally, but fundamentally we're doing it for others. Don't forget that. So great to see everybody. You know the usual gig. I'll be back in 2 weeks for this. So much time, so much fun spending time with you. Questions were great. I really enjoy it. So until next time, not just merely pleasant dreams, pleasant lucid dreams. Bye-bye, everybody.